Hello, everyone, and a very warm, enthusiastic welcome to the second call in our 8-day peace training camp series, peace team training camp. The word team is very operative here. I'm very excited to have with me today both Marilyn King, the inspiration and seed of 8-day peace team training camp, and Peace is the Only Gold, a project of Pathways to Peace. And this is in collaboration with Heart Mastery, and this happens to be our Heart Mastery members-only call. But we have expanded the definition of member today to include all of you who are here and all of you who are listening to this archive who are emissaries passionate about peace in yourselves and in the world. We have one such ambassador and emissary with us today that has been a deep, moving inspiration in my own life, Gita Ryle, who brought peace within her to circumstances that were far from peaceful in her growing up in the Holocaust. Gita, first just want to say thank you so much for being here with us and welcome.
Thank you. I'm honored to be invited. And I hope I can fulfill your expectations.
Well, for me, it's just luxurious to get to soak in your presence. We'll see if other people have expectations. I'm already satiated just being here with you. Before we dive in to interview Gita about her amazing life and the incredible choices she's made internally as well as externally as a torch to the light of peace, Marilyn King and I launched this program this morning with some founders of Pathways to Peace. And we'd love to do a recap for those of you who are not on the first call. So first, Marilyn, if you could just share with us what Olympian thinking is and what Olympian thinking has to do with peace.
Yes, thank you, Sheva. And I'm delighted to be on this call and looking forward to the interview.
And Marilyn, if you could speak just a little louder, that would be great.
Yes. So most people are not aware that the purpose of the Olympic Games, the modern games, when Pierre de Coubertin envisioned them, was to educate youth through sport to create a better and more peaceful world. So the Olympics is specifically designed to advance and evolve peace. And as an Olympian, I have been thinking for many years and working in a variety of ways on if we take the very best of what we learn and what we know from sports about team and effective teams and exceptional human performance and apply that to peace. Sheva and I are now learning to be training partners together and bring the best of the skills and tools and passion that we have together to take a look at, you know, how we become team and how we can facilitate others to really step up to the next level and apply Olympian thinking to what it brings to when we think about peace through the Olympian thinking framework and to what that kind of thinking brings to the notion of team and how we would apply it to ourselves as a group of people who want to be an effective team as it relates to peace. So it's a very exciting beginning.
Beautiful. Thank you, Marilyn. And can you give us the three cornerstones of Olympian thinking?
Yes, and it came out of an extraordinary experience I had in training for my third Olympic team and explored, you know, what is it, how could something so outrageous have happened? And from the field of exceptional human performance, what I distilled was that three things are always present when ordinary people or groups of people do something extraordinary. And first, they are passion-powered. And when you are passionate power, there are all kinds of things that come along as part of the results of being connected to something that you are passionate about. The second part is that these individuals and organizations are vision-guided, understanding how the impact of what and how we think on our ability to accomplish that which we care about. And the third component is action-oriented, that there have to be daily practices that are mental, physical, and even spiritual to my way of thinking. But the synopsis is that Olympian thinking says that when people achieve something extraordinary, they are passion-powered, they are vision-guided, and they are action-oriented.
Beautiful. Thank you, Marilyn. And tell us how you apply those three things to peace and to teams, and then we're going to hear how Gita, without having the benefit of your training as an Olympic athlete, found that as a little girl living in Nazi Germany.
Yes, and she is, you know, an embodiment of, you know, what I talk about and share. And basically, when you apply that trilogy to how we think about peace, it becomes very clear that we have two of the three things that are necessary. Most people really want to live in peace and care deeply, and most people are willing to do something, but they don't exactly know what to do, and they may be doing things, and some of them may be, you know, quite effective, but when you add, you know, kind of an Olympic gold medal type thinking to how we think about peace, it really creates much more efficient, effective, and helps us think systemically. So applying Olympian thinking to peace has to do with being really fully informed in a lot of ways about peace. And in terms of team, it's applying Olympian thinking by asking ourselves, what is it that we know about really effective and championship teams? And as those who care about peace and can envision ourselves as part of a global team, we want to make sure that we embody those championship qualities and traits as a group and team of people focused on one of the desires throughout humankind and human history, which is to live in a world that works for all.
Beautiful. I can't think of a better entree into Gita, who has, from the inside out, been creating a world that works better for all. Gita, tell us about your life and how these things Marilyn was just talking about have played out through you in your life.
Well, do we want to start from the beginning or what I have achieved now as a result of the background that I have lived? I'm a survivor of World War II, and I try to share my life now with students and adults at every level when they are hear about something about World War II, either through middle school when they read Anne Frank, or in high school, in college, when they study the Holocaust. And what I find is that because I survived, and when I die, there'll be very few left that are living voice that all of this happened. So my purpose now is really to let people know who want to listen that there was a World War II and there was a Holocaust, and that we should never forget it, that it must be carried on, that it did happen. And as I talk to different people, I hear that, you know, there are people that do not believe now and maybe in the future that this never happened. So I have made it my purpose to let people know that I did live through it. So I don't know how you want me to start, but I was born. I don't know if you've read some of the articles that was in the Sentinel that gives you a little background, but I was born in Vienna, Austria. And
let me just interject there, Gita. Many of you who joined us received those articles and emails, but I will also make sure when we post this call on the Facebook page for those of you that have joined us through Facebook, to post the articles about Gita there so you can see her face and learn more about her there.
Okay. Anyway, I was born in 410 of 1932, and I always tease the kids because I make them figure out mathematically how old I am. So, anyway, I'm 81, and I'm amazed that I've survived and that I can do this interview. So I was had my family was my mother and my dad and my sister, who's Renee, who's 3 years older than I, and I. And we lived average life. My dad worked. My mom, who was actually a pianist, but she, you know, took care of us. And we lived an average life, and till 1938 when Hitler decided to, well, he took over Germany and had people believe that life could be better. And he decided that he also wanted to conquer the rest of the Europe and eliminate as many Jews as he could. So in 1938 was the Anschluss, which means that Germany and Austria became one, because the Austria didn't have an army, so there was no, you know, there was no way of fighting them. So they came in and they, you know, promised a lot of good stuff, jobs, and et cetera, et cetera. So the first thing that they did, this is not visual, so it's kind of interesting, because usually I show a what's called a Reisepass, like a passport, which every Austrian had to fill out. And the main thing that's in it is a picture of me with that I'm a student, et cetera, et cetera, plus a red J, which is shows that I'm Jewish, and that was their way of kind of doing a census of the people in Vienna and Austria. So anyway, the next thing that happened was that the Germans asked for a lot of the Jewish men to come and work in labor camps. And my father and mother talked, and they decided that he was going to leave with some other men to go to Belgium, because that was neutral at the time, and as soon as he gets settled, he was going to have us come over. He did leave, and I was, I guess I was 6 and a half at the time, and didn't understand, because he was, you know, he was my special, special dad. I was his little princess, and he said, I'll see you soon, I'll see you soon. But anyway, he left, and then the Kristallnacht started, which was the night that every Jewish store and temple, all the glass was broken. And then we realized that something is not right. So my mother, naturally, I didn't understand what was going on. I was just scared. And my mother had to decide what to do. And if we stayed with her, I probably wouldn't be talking to you. But she had heard that there was a Jewish organization that was started by the Rothschilds, a family, and other wealthy Swiss families who put money together and did an organization called OSE, which stands for Œuvre au Secours des Enfants, which means Help to Save the Children. So that was organized. There was also another organization called Kindertransport, which a lot of Jewish kids were taken to England and lived the war years over there. We were taken to France. So anyway, my mother signed us up, and usually while this was all going on, my mother never left me out of the apartment, because she said, you know, I always say that my mother was blonde with blue eyes, and so was my sister. She had long braids, and she didn't look Jewish, but I was dark-haired, and I guess I look Jewish. So she felt like it was very important that I stay safe in the apartment in case somebody went to the door or anything like that. So the only time I came out of the apartment was to go to this organization and sign up for leaving Vienna. And anyway, a lot of different incidents happened, but I don't want to take too much time in a lot of details, because there's a lot to say. So we were signed up, and we left on March 22nd, 1939. My mother packed a little suitcase for each of us, and she took us to the train, and we said goodbye to her, not knowing if we'll ever see her again. And both my parents had told my sister, before all of this happened, that she had to take care of me, and she was 3 years older than I. So I, you know, she promised she would, you know, stay with me at all times. And to also, if there was a difficulty at any time where she couldn't make a decision of something that was asked for her, to say, I have to check with my father before I can make a decision. So that was a safety valve for later on in the war. Anyway, so we knew nobody on the train, and we were taken to Paris. And there, outside of Paris, there was a villa that they turned into a children's home. So that was the first children's home we were in, and that was before the Germans came into France. So, it, you know, we were scared because we didn't know why, you know, all this was happening. And the teachers and the people from Paris came to see us on the weekends and said, don't worry, the war will be over soon. So, and, you know, they tried to make it as calm as they could for us. And that was fine till the Germans entered Paris. Then they had to quickly take all of us down to the center of France. And we were then in a big chateau that was empty, and they made it into a children's home. So we were about, you know, between 250, maybe 300 kids, I don't remember, but there were three groups. There was the older group, middle group, and younger group. My sister was in the middle group, I was in the younger group. And there we stayed. I'm trying to abbreviate a lot because the time. We stayed there till the Germans came and actually to the chateau and took away some of our teachers and the older children. And some people just took the middle kids and the younger groups, and they took us down towards Marseille, which was a port in the south of France. And they said that there were three ships that were leaving for the two for America and one for Israel, and two ships had left, and we got there to go on the third ship. And we were ready to board when the Germans came into Marseille, and so we had to hide because they said if we stayed, if we had gone on the boat, they would have blown up the boat. So here we had to hide again. Anyway, so then they said, we cannot bring you back to a Jewish children's home. We have to distribute you because now it's too dangerous. The Germans are all over France, and they're going to be looking, you know, for Jewish kids, Jewish people also. So anyway, I need to go back to when we were in the chateau. An incident happened that my father somehow found out where we were while we were in the chateau. And he took a job nearby at the retirement home, doing anything he could so that on the weekends he could come and see us. And he came twice to visit us, and I was just so excited. I figured now everything's going to be okay. Well, sadly, a French person, I tell the children, you know, there's the yin and yang of life. There are the people who believe in helping to save children and the world. And then there are people that just want to save themselves. So sure enough, there was a French person who found out he was Jewish, and he denounced him. So he let the German people know. Actually, there was a lot of French people that worked for the Germans, that he was Jewish so he could get his job. So we didn't see him after that, and we found later after the war that he had been shipped to a concentration camp that was in Drancy, above Paris, that was started by the Germans, but the French people were running it. And he was there in 1942. He was shipped to Auschwitz, and that was the year that every train that came, they eliminated everybody that couldn't work or they needed room for the next train to come, because it was definitely the elimination camp. So he died there with other family members, that we found that out after the war. So here we are. Okay, now we have to get out of Marseille, and so we were distributed in different groups, and about 8 or 10 of us were taken and put into a French Catholic convent. And it was just, I think, below, between Grenoble and Lyon. And there, only the Mother Superior and the priest knew we were Jewish. Everybody else knew that we were orphans. We had false passports, that we were born in Alsace-Lorraine in case we had an accent, and that we parents, we didn't have parents, and so we were integrated with the other children, and we went to mass twice a day, and we did all the chores and everything else. And actually, I felt very comfortable there because that was the first time since we were separated from our family that I felt stability. And anyway, so my sister didn't feel too comfortable there. Now, remember, she was 3 years older than I. So the Germans started coming in and checking any place they could if French people were hiding Jewish children. And so Mother Superior called us into her office, and she says, you know, it's getting a little bit scary, and we want you to be safe. So if you want to stay with us and be part of our group, then that would be fine. But if you don't, we need to find a place for you. So my sister then said...
Didn't she ask you to convert to Catholicism?
Yes,
to
be part of them and stay there.
Become nuns, basically.
Yeah. So that's when my sister said, well, I can't make a decision till I check with my father.
Mm.
So Mother Superior was wise enough, and so she says, okay, we will find a place for you. So that's when we were split up, and we were put into individual farms, my sister in one and I in another. Some of the other kids were put in either the bakery or things down in Romans, which is the town, and the surrounding areas is where we all were. But we could not connect with each other because that was scary and not safe. So we never knew till after the war, when we had a reunion many years later, where those other children that were in the convent went. And that's when we found out that one was at the bakery, the pharmacy, the shoe store, all different places in town. And my sister and I were each in a farm. Her farm was a wonderful family, a mother and a father and a grandmother and a brand new baby girl born. So my sister always wanted, in the children's home, she always helped the nurses and the doctors. She wanted to be a nurse, so she was perfect to take care of this baby. And again, she didn't look Jewish, so she was able to be out more. And again, only the father of the farm knew we were Jewish. The mother, all the other people there did not know. We were just orphans. And my family was a mother and a father and 3 girls. One was older than me, one was my age, and one was younger. And again, only Monsieur Flocard knew, and they just knew I was I lost my parents. So I lived with them, and I saw my sister once in a while when things were safe. But during the time we were on the farm, I really, for the first time, understood what a war was, because up to then we were running and hiding. But in the time there is when the Americans came into the war, and they were fighting the Germans, and the Germans were starting to lose. And there were bombs. We were out in the fields with the sheep and the goats, and the bombs would be coming down, and we'd have to run into hiding. And the Americans and the Germans would fight across the highway. So, and we saw things that, kids should not see. But anyway, so we stayed there till the end of the war. And there were incidents there that, amazingly, that you know, wondered how we survived, because we were close to death a few times, but somehow it didn't happen. So after when the war ended, the organization who's kept track of, you know, every place we went, also want to mention that my mother, which you probably wonder what happened to her, well, she was in Vienna when we left, and there were people all over Europe putting ads in the paper to try and help people get out and offer jobs. And she saw an article, an ad in a paper about people in England needing someone who cooks, and she learned how to cook and bake very well. And so she, without speaking, she wrote it in German because she didn't speak a word of English, and they sent her a ticket, and my mother spent all of the war years in England cooking and for different places and different people. So she kept in touch with the OSE through Switzerland. The Red Cross of Switzerland would get letters from my mother. They send it to the OSE, and the OSE would answer, your girls are fine, they're in the, you know, north of France, they're in the middle of France, they're in the south of France, and that's all she knew, and we never heard about her till after the war. So it was too dangerous for us to correspond with her. So so the OSE took us from the farm, and it was kind of hard to leave because I kind of got attached to the family, yet, you know, I wanted to know if I could find my, you know, my own family. So they took us back to Paris, and they then told us about our mother in England, and so we took a little boat across the channel, and that was in, let's see, that was, goodness me, I'm forgetting the date right now. But anyway, we got to England, and I remember looking at my mom and telling my sister, you know, before we got there, I says, how am I going to talk to her? I forgot my German. I only spoke French. My mother spoke English and German. So my sister still remembered some German, so she translated a little bit. And after a while, my German came back. I had a strange feeling towards my mom at that time, because I think I felt abandoned because I didn't understand why, you know, she let us go. And it was a strange relationship for a little while. But anyway, we mended, and then we were fine. And so we lived in England just in long enough to get our visa. We had to be sponsored by a family member in America to be able to come. And I tell the kids, too, you know, in those days, unless you got sponsored by someone, you couldn't come to America. Anyway, we did, we were sponsored, and we came on Armistice Day, November the 11th, 1946. We were able to go. My mother saved enough money for the ship, and the last people that my mother worked for, they were very nice people, and they paid for our fare, and we came on the Queen Elizabeth, the second trip it made after World War II. And so we arrived in New York, November the 11th, 1946. My mother's younger brother and younger sister had left Vienna just at the as things were happening, and they were sponsored by other relatives that were here before the war, I mean in America. And so my aunt Sally, my mother's younger sister, met us at the boat, and we stayed one night in New York, and then we went to Detroit. That's where my aunt lived. And so anyway, we my mother right away got a job baking for a big hotel in Detroit, and my sister and I went to school. And I haven't talked too much about the emotional feeling of me as a human being for being pretty confused of who I was
what I'm supposed to be and all that stuff. But that would take another session. So
well, Gita, the piece that I really do, no pun intended, P-E-A-C-E and P-I-E-C-E, want to focus on with you is, first of all, okay, you've done a beautiful job describing to us the upheaval of a child experiencing war.
Yes.
But you couldn't have survived that without an internal reference point of peace.
Well, I was fortunate that the beginning, up to the time I was separated from my family, I had a wonderful basic beginning of love and peace. And my father was a wonderful person, always helping everybody. So, yes, that is, I think, the basic thing that helped me. As I became more of an adult, I realized that survival was to get to know who I am and what the world is about. I didn't trust humanity because, you know, especially men, you know, they wanted to... They're the ones with the uniforms and guns. And then there were wonderful men in my life, some teachers and my father, who died. So I was very confused. Anyway, I got married. I'm skipping a lot, but I wanted to just say how I got to the place where I am today. When my children, two of my three kids were born, they were the age where I was separated from my family. I was getting physically sick. I had getting ulcers and anxiety attacks. And the doctor said, you know, you have to get help. And that was the first time that I really was exposed to therapy. And I've a lot of therapy to understand and to live, to learn to live, because I think a lot of my time was existing, didn't understand where I was supposed to be. So with a lot of this work, I realized that the work that I have to do is towards letting people know that I made a choice of living in peace and promoting peace. So I think that my talks, when I talk to the kids, are mainly telling the story, but then telling them that the choices that they can make, if they are willing to have a better life, because I talk a lot in where the children have problems, and I showed them that I made a choice. I could have become, you know, one of the people who wanted to kill others, but I decided that that's not the route to go, and so I let them know that.
So tell us about that inner decision, Gita, because one of the things that's so amazing is that you and your sister essentially went through the same circumstances but made very different inner choices.
Yes, yes, that is true. And my sister, who's 3 years older, is still alive. She lives in Los Angeles, and she cannot talk about what happened to us. She tried to talk one time, and she said she'll never do it again. And she chose to just, you know, I don't know what you call it, be in denial. She says, it happened. I don't want to talk about it. And she, sadly, is physically... not in good health. She has scoliosis, rheumatoid arthritis, and she's lost her eyesight. She is existing. I decided that I didn't want to just exist. I wanted to live. And the only way is to be able to share and to not be... What did I tell the kids? I try to teach them forgiveness. And the forgiveness that I learned for me was that if I can get rid of the demons in me, the negativity, the revenge, the hatred, all of those things, I can forgive, but you never forget. So I tell the kids, the forgiving is yourself so that you can live a healthy life. The never forgetting is important, but it's not holding on to whatever incident someone does to you. So do I forgive Hitler? No. For Hitler has, and the Germans have their own, what is the word that you would use, karma that they have to live with. But I am not going to live that karma in my body, mentally and physically, because that will make me sick. And then I figured that they would win. So forgiveness, but never forget, is what I say. And the other thing, I need peace around me. I avoid, you know, if I can show people that we can live in peace, it's great. But when there are people that, no matter what you say, that you won't change them, then I kind of stay away from that. But I noticed that with the children in school, even the adults, they show me that it's very important what I'm doing, and that they look at their lives in a different way when they hear the work that I've done to, you know, to find peace and to only promote peace, because that's the only thing we have. And then I want to say a cute thing, which is out of out of this, but anyway, I just talked to my younger son, and we talked about music, and all of my children are very musical, and so was my my mother, her sister, her brother. My grandfather was a cellist, and in Vienna they always had music. And I never said that, you know, I'm a Jewish mother, but I never said that I needed a doctor, a lawyer, and a CPA. I said, I want musicians, and I'm very happy to say that I have all musicians. And we talked, and I said, you know, music is peace. Music is love. Music is faith. Music can bring peace. Because it's just a wonderful thing. So I just thought I'd interject that, because I am not a musician. We skipped a generation, my sister and I, but I love it. And, I promote it. I'm going to sponsor some children. Never been in a live orchestra this summer, and I'm going to take them to some concerts. I love children, and that's my purpose, is to really make their lives as good as we can, because that's what they deserve.
So, Gita, you
offered us some best practices that I just want to highlight here.
Okay.
First of all, an inner choice,
mm-hmm.
a moment of reckoning inside yourself to
yes.
consciously choose not just to exist, but to live.
Yes.
And you discovered in making that choice that peace is not suppressing, denying, or tolerating the intolerable.
Mm-hmm.
It's meeting it fully,
yeah.
with forgiveness of yourself for your reaction
mm-hmm.
to it,
mm-hmm.
not forgetting what happened so
right.
you can avoid it in the future,
mm-hmm.
but not holding on to it in your body.
Exactly.
So this is a very important best peace practice
mm-hmm.
for meeting what isn't peaceful as a peace creator.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I really hear implicit in what you're sharing is to align with what you love
mm-hmm.
and to spread it. To give it to others. So your love of music and harmony, which of course we know itself is a kind of peace, and your love of music and harmony is something that you've invested in, even though the nature of your upbringing had it such that you weren't a trained musician,
right.
you saw to it to surround yourself with music, to inspire your children to that, to give the gift of music to other children, to be an alignment lightning rod of that core value of yours in the world. That's the best practice that I would invite all of you listening to seek in your lives, even in this moment, in your own introspection. What is it you want to be a lightning rod for? What is it that you need to not deny, not suppress, not hold in your body, but acknowledge the truth of forgive yourself for reacting to, forgive the situation without forgetting it, so that you can move on fully alive rather than just subsisting and existing. And in doing that, what would you like that free energy to then be a lightning rod for in the world? This is the life I see you choosing to live, Gita. Mm-hmm. And you and your sister, perhaps somewhat tragically, are sort of like a double-blind study in that she made a different inner choice.
Yes. Yes.
And the results are playing out in her body and her differently.
Yes. Yeah, she, you know, she does, she's very... I don't know how to describe it. I love my sister, and I talk to her nearly every other day. And she just does things automatically and doesn't have the, sadly, you know, she doesn't have that TLC to give or to receive. Because a lot of times I'm very touchy and loving and hugging person, and I, you know, sometimes say, you know, at the end of our conversation, I said, I love you. And she said, mm-hmm. And one time she said, I love you. She has a difficult time. And like I said, it's sad, but that's the choices, you know, that she made. And she's married. And
Pizza, I just want to interject. This brings us back, actually, to Marilyn's Olympian thinking as it applies to peace. And the first thing that she said, you know, the first cornerstone of Olympian thinking is passion.
Yes.
So if you're cut off from your emotions and your passion,
that's right. You don't
then
have...
you can't really build peace.
That's right, yeah. So it's sad because her relationship with her children is very different than mine. And I have connection and very close to my three children, four grandchildren. She has six beautiful granddaughters, and I'm very close to all of them. And but she has a difficulty. She's more critical about them and stuff. And it's, you know, like I say, we can't change people. She chose that. But I try and be there as a good, you know, as a loving sister. And she knows what I do. And she says, yeah, I'm glad that you're doing it. But she says, I can't do what you do.
Well, in her own way, Gita, she is an equal service to us. Because without her expression in the experiment, we wouldn't know the potency of the inner choice that you made as an invitation to our lives.
Yeah, I'm kind of sad, you know, I would like it to be different, but, you know, and she also chose a partner, which, you know, I was very fortunate that my husband was very, very open in me getting help, whatever I needed. He just wanted me to be happy and content, and he saw the struggle that I went through with all of my emotions, and he was very, very supportive. Sadly, he died of cancer the 24th of June, 20 years ago. And my children called me, and actually my children came up and spent the time with me, and we kind of had a nice time together watching videos of the good times that my husband and my children all have together. And I have a bench near the ocean here for him, and we went and sat on the bench and took pictures. And so I have wonderful memories of my 36 years with my husband. I miss him. I wished he could spend this time with me too, but I realized that I have to accept what he is, and I'm content with my life. And as I say, if I didn't have my family, who's very close to me, and friends, it would be a little harder. So I'm very blessed, and we'll see what happens. I continue to do my talks to the schools, and now I have adult groups that have signed me up already for the fall, and I will do it as long as I can.
Gita, there's another implicit peace practice that you are embodying and role modeling that I want to bring forward, which is asking for help.
Yes.
And that's a part of this Olympian thinking that Marilyn is offering us of teams.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes we can't make peace or create peace or recognize peace by ourselves. Sometimes we need, as you had, a psychologist there to help us reframe or help us forgive a perception of something.
I studied a lot of psychology. I did classes and I did groups and I had different people. I learned that the best therapy that helped the most for me being able to look at things was, I'm not going to say it right, but it's cognitive. Cognitive therapy, I think, is very good.
You said it just right.
Oh, good. Anyway, that has helped a lot because you do interact and you really work with the problems that you have. And so, you know, I don't know how we want to end this. But
well, is there anything else you would like to share before we open the lines for the group to ask you questions and
well,
share their comments?
Well, maybe I'll ask a question because I kind of condensed the story a bit. But it'd be interesting to see the questions that they may have that I can answer.
Well, in this 8-day peace team training camp, one of the things we're seeking to do is give people practical peace practices. You know, when you become an Olympian athlete of any sort, one of the things you have to do is practice your sport every day.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so you've given us some beautiful peace practices that you've embodied in your life. Practices like asking for help,
yes.
Confronting issues rather than denying, suppressing,
mm-hmm.
or stuffing them into your body.
Exactly.
But confronting them not in a blaming way, but in a self-forgiving and loving way.
Yes.
Aligning with what you love and focusing your attention and your energy behind the harmony of that love. And spreading that by sharing it with others. All these things that you've given us are beautiful peace practices. Marilyn, before we open the larger lines for other people's questions and comments on the call, anything you want to add as the champion of Olympian thinking for peace?
Well, thank you, Esheva, and it has been such an honor to be here and to be, kind of on the receiving end of this wonderful and important storytelling. And one of the things I was very touched by, among many, was what you said, Gita, about your love of music and thinking with Esheva here on the line and understanding the way you do, Esheva, about, heart coherence. And we know that music, as you were saying, you know, the harmony of music, there are many kinds of music, but music certainly has that ability to create, you know, a heart coherence, a rhythm and other things that are synonymous with peace. So a lot I ask people to pay attention to, you know, what is the music that you're listening to? And if you're listening to, you know, things with, you know, just really, you know, kind of, you know, ugly, you know, lyrics, you know, it's very important to pay attention to what's happening in your body versus when you listen to things that create the kind of coherence and state that allows us to be peace and to express that peace in the world. So another very powerful peace practice is paying attention to, you know, what is the song, what is the music that you listen to, particularly in the morning, if you listen to music in the morning, that helps create, you know, that coherence. And be a guide and a grounding throughout the day. So I found that to be just really delicious and delightful. Thank you for that, Gita.
Yeah, well, that's for me, you know, the music that is peaceful, that is harmonious, and it's more, it does, I don't need the words. I need just, you know, more, I guess.
Yes.
The instruments and the stuff.
Yes.
It's very peaceful for me. And
yes.
Like I say, my children love it too.
Yes. It can be the voice of the cello or the voice of the flute. It doesn't have
yes.
to be the words. You're right.
Marilyn, I'm so glad you brought this up because it relates, and Gita actually role modeled this too. It's one I forgot to mirror back, a best peace practice that often we don't allow ourselves or afford ourselves the opportunity for is not just being selective about what music we listen to, but about what conversations we listen to and are a part of. People fill themselves with the evening news and the negative reports
yeah.
that go on,
mm-hmm.
or even with friends that speak negatively toward them. And one of the things you said, Gita, is you like peace, you value peace,
yes.
and you choose to create a peaceful environment and avoid the things that disrupt that.
Exactly. I work very hard at that, and I'm pretty intuitive. I guess my mother was too. And so I can tune in to people, and if I see that they are angry and have, you know, a lot of things on their mind and don't want to make a change, then we have to let them go. And then hopefully, you know, they will, when they're ready, do something. So I do, I don't like, you know, the news are there, sadly, but
I when people have conversation, I say this. I say, you know, there's all kinds of things going on in the world. I said, if you can do something to make a difference in what's upsetting you about the news, then I respect you. But I said, if you're just going to talk about it, make a lot of noise, and be negative, then I don't know what to say. Now, I found a purpose in my life to share with people that I lived through the war, I survived, and that when someone tells them that it never happened, they can say, no, I met someone that lived it. When I die, they will have videos, and because all of us survivors have done a video with Spielberg, and it's at USC archives, and the teachers can, you know, get some of the interviews. But when the response that I get from the children is, we want to see someone live, and they do, and they hug me, and they send me beautiful letters just saying, wow, we're so glad that you shared what you shared. And I think that in my way, my little way, I have made a difference with a lot of students and adults in looking at life in a more peaceful way, I hope.
Mm. Well, Gita, you've just given us some more practical peace practices. One of them is, you know, purpose is a peace practice.
Yes.
To have a sense of purpose allows us to organize ourselves, our intentions, our attention, to focus, to choose what to pay attention to and not. And that gives great inner peace that I can see in you and others who live with a sense of purpose. That's one of the things you just shared.
Mm-hmm.
And another is, again, this idea of what to accept and what to reject as far as what kind of diet you have with your attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's a kind of mastery, because it's the balance of not denying what's happening, as you emphasized, but also not dramatizing and indulging what's happening. Yeah. So the other peace practice you've given us is action.
Yeah,
which
is action. It's a lot of waste of energy if you talk about all of the awful things that are happening in the world, but you're not doing something to make a change.
Mm-hmm.
And so this
speaks to another Olympian thinking pillar that Marilyn's given us,
mm-hmm.
of the action step. And it's a crucial one that you're bringing forward in this moment to me, because so many people mythologically and incorrectly think of peace as passive.
No.
And
yes,
you
yes.
are very much showing us that peace is purposeful and proactive.
Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be, you know, active and do whatever you can. I mean, sometimes there's a situation that there's nothing we can do. But whatever little thing, little seed that you can plant towards making peace in your environment, that will help to grow, and we hopefully it'll spread. But that's the only way.
You're reminding me of one of my favorite Dalai Lama quotes is that we do what we do each day.
Mm-hmm.
We do it with the utmost sincerity, and then we let go in peace, knowing the results are out of our hands.
Exactly. That sounds good. I wish I could say that. Say it as good as you can say it.
Well, that was the Dalai Lama that said it.
I just get
to quote him.
Yeah.
Shall we open the lines for people's comments and questions? Let's see how we can do here. I will be manually muting your line if we get a lot of background noise from it. You can manage that yourself once the lecture mode is turned off by pressing *6 to mute yourself, or pressing *6 again to unmute yourself to share. So we have taken it off of lecture mode. Is there anyone who has a question or a comment for Gita or Marilyn or me?
Hi, it's Bernice.
Hello, Bernice. Welcome.
Hi. First of all, thank you, Sheva, and thank you, Marilyn. This is awesome. I'm loving every moment. And Gita, I would like to say a special thank you to you for your presence and the gifts of your wisdom and your words that you're sharing from your life experience. My question is, many times you've mentioned throughout your story here that you were leaving out a lot of details because there wasn't enough time. So I am wondering if you have a book or is there somewhere we can read more about the details of your life?
Well, there is actually nearly a two-hour video that is in the archives of USC, and I have a copy of it. And then there's been articles in the paper. I have not written a book because so many people write books, and I said I'd rather be visual and verbal in telling my story. So I will talk to Sheva and see what we can do about that, that you can, you know. Do you have any questions that you...
I just wanted to know more about your story and filling in the blanks of, and some more of the links in between the gaps in your story.
So we will be posting the newspaper article that was written about Gita, and we'll see if there might be some way to access this two-hour video. I know you were a part of the interviews that Steven Spielberg did when he was producing, is it Schindler's List? Or?
No. This has nothing to do with Schindler's List. What his goal was to interview, before all of us die, enough people to just have a video of our story. So they came to our home and they interviewed me in 1996, and my sister, I believe, was interviewed in 1995. So those videos are the story we told then about what happened to us. And there is, I don't know if there's a full video. There's a lot of the schools take videos, and I could get one of those and see if there's more information.
That would be wonderful if we can post one of those online, Gita, maybe.
But pretty much, you know, the idea of my life is the details to me is that, you know, you see a young person who didn't understand what was going on in life and came out of it not trusting society, not knowing who I was. I didn't want to be Jewish because they wanted to kill me because I was Jewish, and I had to learn all of that stuff again. So, you know, I don't know. I talk more about the emotional place that I was in with the anger and all of that stuff, and that I thankfully got rid of. So, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, well, and that's really the relevance. I've been to some of the school programs with you.
Yes, that's right.
And, you know, we think this is a historical story, but sadly it's not. Mm-hmm. Bullying, persecution because of race or physical appearance or ethnicity is as common now as it was in Nazi Germany across the world.
Yes.
And the children in our schools here in the United States are subject to this every day.
Yes.
And Gita and I were at an at-risk high school earlier in the year, and it was amazing to me to see the kids connecting, not with the details of Gita's story, but with the dignity that Gita met undignified circumstances with, because they're facing the exact same thing, parental abandonment that they don't understand.
Yes.
The emotional connection is the part that I see you living and embodying, Gita.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was you, Bernice, is that right, that you were interested in more of the details?
Right, because what I'm hearing is that there's so many layers and dimensions, Gita, to your life that can, well, like you said, they touch so many areas, the bullying, the abandonment, and also being a survivor, and there are so many people that don't even believe that it happened.
Right.
I just thought maybe if it was written in a book, it would be something that would exist for a long time, but you have it on film, and that's your... beautiful way.
Well, there is a lady that I met who wrote a book, and she found out in later life that she's Jewish, and she's embracing Jewishness right now. And she came over here, and she wanted to do a book which sounded interesting to me and is about how, you know, other survivors, not just me, but I'd be part of it. Like I am, there was a Gabriel Constance wrote a book about women surviving their spouse's death. And he has a paragraph in there about me that talks about how I got through the war and then how I survived a death, you know, of my father-in-law mm-hmm. and my husband within a month. And so there is more tragedy that happened in later life than just my childhood. But somehow, you know, something kept me going. And I feel really now, whatever my time is left here, to share what I can and be content. This is the happy word is, but being content and living life as best as we can, which I'm 81 now, is a gift. And I do appreciate that I recognize this now, because for so many years I did not. So, you know, life is what it is. One day at a time.
Oh, Gita has healing hands. I got a back rub on that one. I wish you all could have that experience vicariously. Bernice, thank you so much. We'll see what we can do to get the two-hour video of Gita, or at least some segments of it, on YouTube through our Facebook page.
Thank you.
One thing that stands out to me very strongly from having heard more of the detail of Gita's story over the years in the schools with at-risk kids is the fact that your father found where you were and at risk of his life came on weekends to visit you in hiding.
Yeah.
And what an incredible surprise that was, and stability and continuity it gave you. And at the same time, how you never knew when the last moment was going to be and who is it before he was captured and exposed and killed. You didn't know was the last visit. And it's such a potent, and how you spent really your whole life looking for him.
Yeah. And I, you know, I say when my father-in-law died, which I took care of him as my husband was ill with cancer, his father died at 91 and a half, and the incident that really was unbelievable for me is that I went to see him. He died on a Sunday. I went to see him Sunday afternoon, and he died during the night peacefully. And I told my husband that I wanted to go and see him, and I did. And the thing that was important there was that he was on a gurney, and I kissed his forehead, and I stroked his head, and I said goodbye to him. And that was 20 years ago. That's when I finally said goodbye to my father. Up to that time, I was always looking. I was thinking what could have been and all this stuff. So that was very important time for me, and that was another part of my growth.
I love how you talk about and value growth, because, again, we think of peace as sort of the static.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. We have peace when we're growing.
Oh, yeah. You never stop. If you stop, that's it.
Not so much peace. That's more stagnation.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely beautiful, Gita. Thank you so much. Anyone else have any questions or comments for Gita this afternoon? Well, your continuous pursuit, Gita. Oh, Dania, I just saw you unmute. Want to share something?
Yes, Gita, I'm so pleased to hear that you mentioned the importance of music in your embodying those coherent, the peaceful feelings. When we were asked this morning or sometime to identify in our lives, in my life, when I felt peace, the first thing that came up to me, for me, was my grandmother playing the piano.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for that, Gita.
Oh, wonderful. Yes.
so many rich teachings in your life, Gita, just in who you are and how you show up. Is there anything else that you would like to leave our listeners with today as they're seeking to recognize and create more peace in themselves and in the world?
Well, I'm not one with wise words, but, try and live life, examine if you're existing or living, and just, whatever, your desire is to reach it. I am content because I know that I have to realize the age I am, and that as I get older, some limitations, but I'm also accepting it gracefully and with honesty. I'm whatever comes up is unknown, and so I'm not going to dwell on it. I'm just going to live every day as best I can. Does that make sense?
It does. You know, Gita, one of the things I've observed about you, and that was the hallmark of our meeting each other, is this thing you pointed to about following your intuition about people and about the choices you make in life. And Gita and I met at the gym, actually.
Yes.
And it was sort of an instant recognition when we were talking about something mundane like the weather, but there was sort of a recognizing, like, oh, we're supposed to do something together.
Yeah.
and an instant love. And that energy of following what you love, the cliche of following your heart, the Institute of Heart Math has made not so cliche in understanding that when we love, it does bring a harmony to our hearts that we experience as peace. When we embody our purpose, we call it at Heart Mastery, our heart's purpose, we do know, as we would say in Heart Mastery, where to put people in our circle of relationship that's at the right distance for us and them to be peace.
Yep.
So we could perhaps say Gita's life is a role model of what it looks like to follow your heart, even in the most extreme of circumstances that human beings face. And the beauty and the contentment and the peace that can come of that, both within and shared with others. Marilyn, any final comments for this call before we reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning for day two of our 8-day peace team training camp?
Just very deep gratitude, and I feel like I am I am feeling what it is you teach so beautifully in terms of cardio or heart coherence. So. Thank you, and thank you, Gita.
Thank you.
Thank you all for giving your attention to Gita's story and to peace in your heart. We look forward to being with you on the same line tomorrow morning, 8:30 a.m. Pacific time. Much love, everyone.
Love, love. Thank you, Gita. Love, love, love.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.